Okay, well, first off, I'd like to thank the Task Force organizers for giving me a chance to talk. I'd also like to thank my collaborators, Jim Klein and Harsh Leica, where most of this work is done at McGill University, though a couple of us have moved on. I should qualify that my talk, or preface this talk, by saying that I consider myself more of a cosmologist. I was interested in the very early universe, and this naturally led me to string theory, which claims to describe physics at very high scales. In this particular case, it led me to the ideas behind reheating in brain world inflationary models. So being a cosmologist, I want to keep the talk more accessible to cosmologists and particle physicists and myself, so I'm skipping out a lot of stringy details, though I assure you they're in this posted publication. You can also ask me more technical questions at the end, and then really technical questions at the bar later tonight. So I just wanted to make sure everyone has the right picture in mind. So starting off on the left-hand side of this view graph, the basic picture we have in mind is the brainless scenario, which was put forth by Henry Tai and his collaborators about 10 years ago. So in it, they imagine the most generic string theory system to be comprised of closed string modes where the massless mode would be identified with the graviton, and it's free to travel throughout space. You can also have stacks of brains, or also have brains which are separated from a stack of brains. And also there are open string modes, which may stretch between brains. They may either start and end on the same brain, or they could go between two different brains. And those are identified with gauge particles. So the standard model is confined to these brains, these hypersurfaces. It was soon early realized, too, that if you imagine this particular configuration, a stack of brains with a probe B brain separated by some distance R, that this separation acts as the inflaton. And so you can get a model of inflation out of this. Although it was also quickly realized that in order to get enough deflation, you needed the separation to be greater than the size of your compactifications. So it wasn't possible to get enough inflation. And there were other issues too, like they had to fix by hand all the background, all the various degrees of freedom. The kind of state of the art nowadays involves these flux compactifications. So you picture some gigantic space, some Calabi-Yau background, and then at various points in that background, you might have flux fields turned on, these flux work compactifications. And the advantage of that is, there are some just phenomenological advantages. These fluxes turn out to develop huge warping. And so as you move down into this warped throat, the scale of physics local to that throat also gets exponentially warped. And so you can, through not quite fine-tuning, but tuning of integers of the order 10, you can explain hierarchies between why, see, gravity is at some fundamentally high scale, but the standard model, which would be localized down at the bottom of the throat, might be at a lower scale. As a cosmologist, people basically just took this picture and embedded it in the throat, and essentially all it's doing is that the warping is providing a new parameter, which you can then tune in order to get enough inflation. And so it was seen as a more promising model of inflation in string theory. Although I'm glossing over a lot of details because I'm not so worried about inflation in string theory, I'm more worried about reheating in string theory. I assure you that the story is much, much more complicated. But this is the basic picture you should have in mind. Off the top of my head, I have a list of some of the benefits you have in the new standard, the new modernized view of what your string background might look like. But what really appeals to me is that a lot of the models of inflation are getting, it's not just your vanilla slow roll type inflation. You're getting fairly unique mechanisms, which are giving rise to fairly unique signatures. But I'm more interested in reheating the process. Well, I'm more interested in reheating, and it turns out that to understand the scale of physics at which reheating is happening, it helps to understand what's happening in the EDS direction of your background. So I have here your radial profile of your of the EDS throat. At the bottom of the throat's called the infrared region. At the top of the throat's the UV regime. And as you move down it, physics is scaled to smaller and smaller energies. Massive modes in this background turn out to be exponentially peaked. So if W is my warp factor, describing a hierarchy, you find that it's exponentially enhanced by that warp factor in the infrared region. This can be understood just in terms of minimizing your energy. Massive modes prefer to live at where they minimize their energy. Another thing to point out is that with deep at the top of your throat in this clavier region, your massive modes are heavily suppressed. They predominantly like to live at the bottom of your throat. And also gravitons, they don't feel the potential barrier of this warp. They have a constant profile throughout the system. Okay. So just keep that in mind, the difference between massless modes and massive modes. I wrote some equation, but I realized this is for people that wanted more details, but you also need the background ansatz, which I didn't write down.
So you're looking at single throat inflation as of reheating, and the reheating stays in the throat.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
And in the paper, we do talk about generalizing it to multi-throat scenarios. So reheating, as you probably all know, is basically the term we use to describe the transferred energy that's locked up in inflation and describing how it gets to the standard model. Phenomenologically, people just imagine some direct coupling, usually imagine a direct coupling between the inflaton and the standard model particles, and then through either perturbative decays or parametric resonance, you can quickly, efficiently excite the standard model. The story in these Brainwell scenarios is a bit more complicated, and it involves a cascade of events. But it's fairly generic. So the inflation happens when your probe brain comes near your stack, falls in towards your stack of brains. But what turns out to happen is that when the probe brain gets within the string length of the stack of brains, that tachyonic instability arises. And there's a rich body of literature at each phase of these of this sequence. But I guess I'm blocking a lot of the words. But what you find is that if there's a fairly efficient transfer of energy into closed string loops, closed strings that are heavily excited, those then decay into their ground state, the unexcited closed string, the graviton, but also their Kaluza-Klein excitations along the radial and internal directions. Those coupled through gravity, coupled to the brain that you think the standard model lives on, fluctuations in the brain, and then those fluctuations coupled to the standard model itself. So in the initial analyses of all these steps, there was no real concern. It turned out if you were to quantify the rates at each of these steps, reheating went through quite efficiently. You wouldn't interfere with baryogenesis or BBN constraints.
Sorry, but you need two different throats because the energy scales you need for the inflation and for the standard model are different, right?
Right. So,
so you have to have an energy transfer via the gravitons into the other throat?
This is an issue. So what I should do then is compare the tunneling timescale to the reheating timescales at each step.
Do you have a kind of radial in the division direction?
There is a radial mode.
So do you improve the stabilization or something? Radial mass in that case?
Yeah,
fixed. Yeah. Is dynamical radial there?
It's fixed in the background by the flexes that you turn on.
Also, essentially, it's extremely heavy.
Yes. At the string scale.
So it does cause problems with inflation, right? But
right.
This is going way.
That's
from
the inflation. I don't worry about it. In the inflationary story, it turns out that the effects of the probe brain have a back reaction which ruin your inflaton potential and stuff. I'm going under the working assumption that we had inflation happen. Now I want that inflationary energy to go into the standard model. Or some other degree of freedom.
I just wonder, the energy scale or temperature scale is low or high?
It's high, string scale.
The temperature the energy scale.
Mm-hmm.
But if the energy scale is above the stabilization scale, then you have to also think about the dynamics of that direction.
Wait, this is at the scales are equivalent essentially. Okay?
There's a lot of interesting papers on that, but that's not what you're talking
that's
about.
That's not at all what I'm talking about, yeah.
The scales are separate.
Okay. But in the reheating analysis, all these steps turned out to be very efficient. There wasn't much concern. The only possible concern that people thought of was at this phase, where your closed strings have decayed down to their lightest states, plus their Kaluza-Klein excitations in the internal directions. And they populate the entire tower of Kaluza-Klein states. And what you might worry is that these really massive states either prefer to decay to only gravitons, so you're producing too much radiation, and this could interfere with BBM, get too much radiation. But it turned out that heavy KK states prefer to decay to lighter KK states, and that's because of the radial profile that I discussed in the previous view graph. Massive states are exponentially peaked. And so from the four-dimensional point of view, the strength of the interaction vertex between really heavy KK states and lighter KK states involves the overlap of three or more exponentially peaked wave functions. But the graviton is just a flat wave function. It has no exponential enhancement. And so, again, it's just seen as another nice feature of reheating in string theory. In these brain world models of string theory, you're not overproducing gravitons. And then it turned out that these light KK states couple to the massive fluctuations of your standard model brain. But I grabbed this graph from a paper by Kaufman and Yi, and they pointed out that there's an extra concern that had been missed or just swept under the rug in the early analyses. And that's that the previous analysis only worried about the ADS part of your backgraph. They only worried about the radial profile of your system. And in truth, you should also worry about the other directions in your compactification. And these typically, especially in the throats, have internal isometries. They have symmetries. And when you think of that, you think of the Withers theorem, you think of a conserved current. And this is especially important for the state that's the lightest state, which has a charge, which is excited along the M5, your other five-dimensional manifold. And so if that's all you had, the lightest KK states at this epoch in your reheating phase, they're going to be stable. Deep down, if all you had is this region where your isometries are intact, this relic will not have a channel for it to decay. It'll be stable. And so this really ruins the whole reheating analysis. Without fine-tuning various parameters, you're going to have a stable, really massive particle in your system. And that will either overclose the universe, it could act like a dark matter candidate, but you have to really fine-tune your parameters. And it seems pretty unnatural. We've already seen how the inflationary setup in these systems are starting to look a bit unnatural, too.
Can it be produced, then, if you have brain collisions, precisely because of that charge?
It's produced at this phase, somewhere in this phase of the heating process, the really heavy KK relics, it turns out to not cost a lot of energy to excite along the other directions. So it can be produced. So that's essentially the problem that I wanted to get at. We have this possibility of this relic, which might severely restrict your parameter space without fine-tuning in these brain inflationary models. And so I wanted to go over now how we're hoping, or how we propose we can overcome this decay over this Rayleigh problem. So I have plotted here the bulk mass, the mass of your particle in the five-dimensional, in your ADS5. The bulk mass arises from being charged in the internal directions. We're interested in the least massive charge state in the four-dimensional point of view. What's the Rayleigh? And this plot's just going to show us that to find the least massive charge state in 4D, since it's a monotonic function, I only need to find the least massive state in 5D. So it kind of simplifies what we need to search for to identify what is the possible Rayleigh. We can ignore the right view graph, but we also looked at different boundary conditions at both the UV and the IR. How is this warp throat smashed onto the cloud VL? And it turned out that this monotonic nature always remains. So all we needed to do was identify the 5D lightest state in five dimensions that has charge in the internal directions. Now, as a cosmologist, it was a bit scary. I had to look at this a lot, which is the TIP2B supergravity action. It has a large field context. There's a lot of different states I had to look at. I can describe in detail for you later. It's even worse in the five-dimensional point of view, because the various states have different polarizations. They look like different fields in the 5D sense. So, for instance, our four form can look like a scalar, a vector, an anti-symmetric two form. And they also fall into different supermultiplets, too. So there's a large spectrum of masses that this system has. Fortunately, there is work by Sarazal and her collaborators, which calculated exactly that, the Kluze-Klein expectations in this particular compactification. And it is found to be this RR four form, the scalar polarization. So this is the possible Rayleigh in this particular background. But that is one of the more favored backgrounds of string theories. I just have some new stats, I guess, about that particular Rayleigh. But the two important points are that now that we know where is the energy locked up in, where is this Rayleigh lying, we know what interaction terms it has. We know what decay channels it can go through. And then I just wanted to point out this one, too. It doesn't lie in the gravity sector of the theory, because since our work has come up, there's been other work doing similar analyses, but they did a more generic approach. And the types of vertices they consider just don't exist for this particular background. And they also make the statement that they can get things to decay on time, no problem. And it actually prefers to decay into the standard model brain as opposed to gravity. But we don't have a direct coupling between this Rayleigh and the standard model brain. That only happens through the graviton. So I think their analysis works in a generic setup, but it misses stuff in a more detailed setup as well. Okay, so we've identified the Rayleigh in this background. The next thing we needed to do is we realize that we don't just have this warped throat where the asymmetries are preserved deep in the throat. It's attached to a collabial, which has no asymmetries. So we needed to quantify the effects of all these distortions to your asymmetry in the ultraviolet, the top of your throat, propagate those effects down into your throat, and find some kind of deformation to your background which can absorb the asymmetry of your background. So our background was type 2B gravity compactified on ADS5 plus Q1. But we're now introducing sources to it, and there's a source for every type of excitation along your internal manifold. And it couples to every field in your system. We chose one, the one that couples to the four form. We want a source that couples to the four form, has some strength, phi tilde, it lives in the ultraviolet. When you propagate that deformation into the throat, you find that its radial profile has to have this form to obey the background equations of motion. We don't want this profile to increase as we go down the throat, because that'll disrupt your background solution. And that places a constraint on this parameter delta, it must be greater than 4. And delta turns out to be related to the mass of the bulk mass of the source that you're considering, which is related to the type of eigenstate you have in your T11. In the conformal field theory language, the story is that you're turning on operators in the conformal field theory, but you should only turn on operators that are irrelevant. Otherwise, you're ruining your conformal field theory if you start considering relevant operators. So the story is almost done. We know where this energy is locked into. It's the 4 form, polarized as a BDS scalar. And now we have to throw in various background corrections, which will absorb the charge of this 4 form. The capital indices run over 1 to 10, so there's many different terms to this interaction. But we should only consider terms where we can only decay the massless particles, because this is the lightest state. We can't just decay the lighter states. Also, the types of corrections you're throwing in, they shouldn't, it's basically a VEV, they shouldn't pick up some preferred direction in R, along R foregrain. You may want the correction to preserve supersymmetry. It has to correspond to the irrelevant operator. And the entire vertex should form a group singlet, so you know that you're absorbing all the charge. So although there is seemingly a lot of different vertices, once you restrict yourself to only those obeying those conditions, there's still a lot you have to look at. That took a long time, for me at least, to find this vertex. So this is the 4 form, the scalar polarization of the 4 form coming in. We had to turn on 2 different background corrections. Both are irrelevant, correspond to irrelevant operators. We can get a mixing to a radial gravity photon, which then decays into gravitons. It's just words. You can read up more in the paper, hopefully. And it turned out that this operator broke supersymmetry. So the statement is that in this throat, in order to get this relic to decay, we had to consider deformations which will break supersymmetry. We were able to find Suzy preserving roots so that the background operators don't, they're at the top of your supermultiplets. The diagram started to get more and more complicated, and they all turned out to be a subdominant in terms of the decay strength. So all that was left, this was the Suzy breaking decay channel that I showed 2 slides before. I dimensionally reduced the system to find out the interaction strength. And at this point, so now we know how long it's going to take for this relic to decay. It depends on various parameters, the amount of warping, which is fundamentally related to the amount of flux you had in your compactification. We have to break supersymmetry, so there's this Suzy breaking strength. So you impose a constraint that you want to decay before BBN. You can work this inequality to make various different constraints in your fundamental parameters. We chose to constrain Suzy. Well, I'm showing you this constraint on the Suzy breaking scale. And it turned out to be at a very high scale. And this is kind of neat because it's consistent with, it turns out the actual constructions break supersymmetry. And it was shown to be of the order of this scale. So the phenomenological constraints are found to be consistent with the more theoretical constraints. Two more slides for you. Once we stared at these interaction vertices enough, remember the game was inserting the radial behavior of your relic, and then the radial behavior of the background corrections. The background corrections decay to the UV, decay to the IR, because you don't want to disrupt your background solution. The massive modes increase or warp in the infrared. And there's a trade-off. We can generalize this nature to other backgrounds then, and the strength of the decay is the trade-off between how much suppression do you get from your background correction and how much warping do you get because of the relics warping. And again, so we played the constraint, we got some generic decay formula. Play the constraint, if you impose this relic decay before BBN, Now, if you tell me in your background of choice, what's the mass, bulk mass of your relic? And how much warping are you imagining this your inflationary scenario happening? I can tell you if this relic will decay on time, or if it's on time to evade BDN constraints, or not. And you can scan the graphs a bit more. I'll talk a bit more about it in the paper. It turns out that the constraints you're getting are much tighter than just the inflationary constraints. And these are coming from a more phenomenological point of view, as opposed to the actual theoretical validity of your construction. It just kind of surprised me. I already knew how complicated the story of inflation was in string theory. Now the story of reheating seems to be getting, well, for me at least, equally complicated. And that's it. Thank you.
Just a quick one. Does the supersymmetry breaking at the source that you're turning on, and do you know if it sort of corresponds to the types of supersymmetry breaking that you'd expect in the spectrum?
Yeah, I
wouldn't have any idea. Just more.